signals to China and to Russia that the United States still has a foothold in that country.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue our conversation with you and post it as a web exclusive at democracynow.org. Kathy Kelly, just back from Afghanistan, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. She's made many trips to Afghanistan. That does it for our show. To see our video and audio podcasts and our transcripts, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid video production fellowships. Find out more at democracynow.org and sign up for our daily digest, our news digest. Send the word Democracy Now! To the number 66866. Democracy Now! One word to 66866. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nirmin Shah, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The 20th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national town hall meeting broadcasting live on Tuesday, June 12th. Tune in to hear the stories from our homeless citizens and people living in poverty. This year, the broadcast originates in Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Tuesday, June 12th, heard right here on this radio station.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
This is WHFR at 89.3, also online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek. It's 1 o'clock, and normally at the time when you hear the new WHFR Journal here on the station making waves. However, the new WHFR Journal will not be heard today so that we can bring you the following presentation, 1968, 50 years later. It's a three-part series hosted by Public Radio's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and we do hope you enjoy it. Susan McGraw and I will be back in a few weeks' time, after a little bit of a summer hiatus, with more of the new WHFR Journal. Please stay tuned. We do hope you enjoy.
A party split, a fractious convention, a violent police action. A half century later, a look at the Democrats' dilemma in Chicago on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Hubert Humphrey, President Johnson's heir apparent, desperately tried to make peace at the Chicago convention.
I say to this great convention tonight and to this great nation of ours, I am ready to lead our country.
Sam Brown, who had worked with the Eugene McCarthy campaign, was stunned at the level of violence on the streets.
The police were beating people on the edges of the crowd. People in the middle of the crowd were being crushed. And then the police came in just swinging clubs and beating everyone in sight. And with tear gas, you couldn't escape it.
We'll remember the turmoil of the 1968 Democratic Convention on the Political Junkie after the news.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the WHFR Neighborhood News. I'm Liz Washington. The Sears department store inside the Fairlane Town Center in Dearborn is one of the four Michigan locations that is closing by the end of the summer, as well as one of the 72 locations closing nationwide. The store has been an anchor store at Fairlane since the mall opened up in 1976. Sears reported that they had a net loss of $424 million during the first quarter of 2018. According to Sears, closing out sales will be starting as early as June 14th. On Saturday, June 9th, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., Henry Ford College is hosting a Household Hazardous Waste Collection Day. The event takes place in parking lots 7, 8, and 9. Wayne County residents with a proof of county residency can safely dispose materials such as household paints and cleaners, batteries, computers, printers and fax machines, cell phones, TV sets, and more. For more information, visit hfcc.edu. Henry Ford College is presenting The Flick. The Pulitzer Award-winning play will run for 8 performances in the Adrae Auditorium in the Fine Arts Building. Performances run June 14th through the 17th, as well as the 21st through the 24th. The play is performed in the space where the audience usually sits, which represents the movie theater where the flick occurs. Patrons will sit on the stage and watch the action unfold in the traditional viewing space. Tickets are $12 or $10 for HFC employees and students with a valid photo ID. Henry Ford College is offering an Associate of Fine Arts degree in Studio Art that is very similar to what most Bachelor of Fine Arts programs in Michigan. The Associate is going to be effective during the fall semester of 2018. All of the Studio Art classes meet 6 hours per week and are aligned with art departments at four-year universities. The coursework that is included in the new Associate of Fine Arts program includes painting, photography, ceramics, and more. All of the students involved in the program are required to participate in an on-campus exhibition prior to graduation. That wraps up this edition of the WHFR Neighborhood News. I am Liz Washington. Thanks for listening to WHFR Making Waves.
Excuse me, miss. Would it be okay if I asked you a few questions about the radio station?
Yeah.
Great. First, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Mrs. Robinson.
In your opinion, what is the best program to have ever graced the airwaves here or anywhere in the world? Perhaps there is a DJ you consider the pinnacle of perfection who you yourself try to emulate?
Scrocking Your Potatoes, Mike D. Mike D.
Oh, that's the program on right before yours, Sunday evenings from 7 until 9 p.m. Where can listeners hear that again?
It's right here on the station Making Waves, WHFR.FM.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us for this special edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The road to the nominating conventions in 1968 couldn't have been more different for the two major political parties. For the Republicans, Richard Nixon was nominated on the first ballot at a stress-free convention in Miami Beach.
8 years ago, I had the highest honor of accepting your nomination for President of the United States. Tonight, I again proudly accept that nomination for President of the United States. But I have news for you. This time there's a difference. This time we're going to win.
That was in July. The Democrats, who met in Chicago a month later, were in disarray. President Lyndon Johnson, haunted by mounting opposition to a war in Vietnam that looked unwinnable, had withdrawn from the race. Robert Kennedy, a late entry into the race, won the big primary in June in California and was assassinated minutes later. The party's likely nominee, Hubert Humphrey, was saddled with supporting LBJ's position on Vietnam when he knew it was a mistake. What nobody could have known was that all the conflicts and divisions within the party would be revealed to the country, to the world. In the streets of Chicago, as police clashed with demonstrators, and on the convention floor, as delegates argued and booed one another over their differences on the war. It was, at least for the Democrats, part of the continuous nightmare known as 1968.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Hubert Humphrey, the loyal vice president, was blindsided when President Lyndon Johnson made this declaration on March 31, 1968.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Humphrey had run for president once before in 1960 when he lost the Democratic nomination to John F. Kennedy. With LBJ out of the race, the party establishment turned to Humphrey to carry the banner, and he accepted the challenge.
I shall seek the nomination of the Democratic Party
By declaring his candidacy so late, he missed all the deadlines to appear on the primary ballots. And so, when all was said and done, he was prepared to go to Chicago that summer and accept the nomination, even though he never won, let alone entered, a primary contest. Ted Van Dyke was a senior advisor to Vice President Humphrey and joins us now. Ted, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. My pleasure.
When Bobby Kennedy and Jim McCarthy were fighting it out in Indiana and Nebraska and Oregon and California, Humphrey was nowhere to be found, at least in the primary states. What was he doing during those months?
Well, frankly, he was at first mulling whether he wanted to even be a candidate. And I think left to his own instincts, he would not have run. He kept delaying a decision. Finally, he had delayed so long, the filing dates for all the primaries had passed. And if he wanted to run, he had to do it in the state conventions and caucus states. Of course, they were far more numerous than the primary states. I had a long conversation with him just before he finally did make a decision. And I said, well, what are you waiting for? And he said, well, I just have a gut feeling that bad things are going to keep happening throughout this year and they're going to engulf me. And in fact, he was right. But nonetheless, he went forward. And by the time we got to the convention, we had a generous majority. In fact, we had a strong majority of delegates even before the California primary. But one of the tragedies, of course, was the murder of Robert Kennedy on that primary night, which cast a pall over everything.
We should note that back then, the primaries did not always determine who was going to be the nominee.
No, that's right. They're now decisive. But back then, there were only a few as compared to the non-primary states.
So Humphrey had to know, going into Chicago, that there was going to be a lot of disenchantment, a lot of anger over how he won the nomination. But even more important, he knew there would be a huge fight at the convention over the party plank on Vietnam.
Yes, there was no doubt about that. We had prepared a statement breaking with Johnson and staking out an independent position on the war, which Johnson frankly bullied Humphrey out of giving before the convention on several occasions. Finally, we reached a compromise with the peace forces, particularly the Kennedy delegates at the convention, but on a peace plank. But Johnson intervened, sent people out there, and as a result, the peace plank was defeated. So we had the worst of both worlds. We'd not staked out our own independent position, and Johnson had destroyed the opportunity to get a common position with the Kennedy and McCarthy delegates. So it was a terrible situation.
Yeah, I had a conversation on this show a while back with Walter Mondale, who was obviously close with Humphrey, and he talked about how Humphrey was boxed in on Vietnam, that he couldn't break with the president, but as a longtime liberal, he had to know that the war wasn't going well. Can you describe the two things pulling at Humphrey at the same time?
Yes. Well, first of all, when he first took office in January 65 as vice president, he thought he and Johnson were on the same wavelength in Vietnam, advisory capacity only, emphasis on economic development. But when the war escalated, he spoke out in a National Security Council meeting against the escalation, which began with a massive bombing in North Vietnam. And Johnson froze him out for about a year and a half from any meetings, any involvement in the Vietnam issue. He finally got back into the flow, but by the end of 1967, I'd say even by the middle of 1967, Humphrey was wholly disaffected and wanted to get out as quickly as we could. And so that was pure agony from that point forward, because he believed we should withdraw and the war should end. Johnson did not want him to dissent. So it was a very, very unpleasant period. And, of course, when he did announce his own candidacy, he knew, which was at the end of April 1968, he knew that he was going to be in constant tension with Johnson until the issue got resolved.
Do you remember having conversations with him as Chicago was approaching?
Oh, sure. But we knew when we got there that there would be difficulty, and Humphrey was in a particularly helpless position. He had no power over the police. That was Mayor Daley's responsibility. He had no power over the war. That was Johnson's responsibility. And he was just terribly caught in the middle. Daley, by the way, had requested federal troops be sent to Chicago in advance to keep order. And when he was turned down, became quite angry and said, well, the Chicago police would take care of things, period. And indeed, they did.
Well, you know, I was just listening, I was just watching his acceptance speech at the on the last day of the convention. And And when Humphrey accepted the nomination, you knew how conscious he was of the party divisions. Let me play a little clip here.
And may I say to those who have differed with their neighbor or those who have differed with a fellow Democrat, may I say to you that all of your goals, that all of your high hopes, that all of your dreams, all of them will come to naught if we lose this election, and many of them can be realized with the victory that can come to us.
You know, Ted, he was on good terms with certainly with George McGovern.
Yes, he was. In fact, McGovern was the first on the podium to join him when his nomination was affirmed. He had an equivocal relationship with Gene McCarthy. They'd grown up together in politics in Minnesota. McCarthy was a very prickly guy, but he had seen Humphrey just before the convention and said he would endorse and help him immediately after the convention, but all the upset and violence which took place there delayed that. But in the end, he did come home, but he did not fully support and engage in the campaign until very late. Another painful part of it was that Humphrey and Robert Kennedy had talked before the California primary, in fact, and had agreed that they would support each other, and Humphrey was quite close to the Kennedys. In fact, in 1960, Robert Kennedy had tried to intervene to get his brother to dump Johnson from the ticket as vice president and replace him with Humphrey. So they understood each other, and then when Robert Kennedy was killed, it took an element of glue out of the party. We just didn't have the unity we could have had otherwise. It was a painful period until end of September when the Vietnam speech really broke things open and we had a normal campaign.
Yeah, I think when you were talking about the tragedy of what might have been with Kennedy, going back to the Humphrey acceptance speech, the vice president referred to exactly that.
Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. Robert F. Kennedy, as you saw tonight, had a great vision. If America will respond to that dream and that vision, if America will respond to that dream and that vision, their deaths will not mark the moment when America lost its way, but it will mark the time when America found its conscience.
Ted, that was pretty powerful.
It was. I did the final drafts of all of Humphrey's speeches, and including that one. And it began as kind of a committee effort, as was often the case with an important speech. Humphrey would ask for input from a lot of people. We tried to keep in all those unifying lines and aspirations, and I think to that degree it worked.
Given the disaster outside the convention hall and the dissension within the hall, do you think that Humphrey felt he made a convincing case for his election in Chicago?
He did the best he could. First of all, Johnson had stopped him from making an independent Vietnam statement before the convention. At the convention, Johnson sabotaged the peace plank, which could have evolved. So the speech was fine, but he knew until there was real movement on the issue, little was going to change. And Johnson really was hostile right up until Election Day. I always doubted at the end if he wanted Humphrey to win the election. And at the end, when we caught the Nixon campaign consorting with the South Vietnamese not to come to the peace table and peace negotiations, Johnson could have made that public and affected the outcome, but he refused to do so after meeting with his advisors. So right until the end, I thought he was very equivocal, and frankly, we were cut off from cable traffic from Vietnam. He was not at all helpful in the campaign.
Ted Van Dyke was a senior advisor to Hubert Humphrey, probably as close to the vice president as anyone on the campaign staff. Ted, it was just wonderful having you reflect back on that lovely and torturous year of 1968.
Yeah, it was a terrible year, and I wish it had never existed.
Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hubert Humphrey did lose the election to Richard Nixon that November. It was a close contest, but he always had that optimism. He was always known for his famous optimism, and that optimism was in clear view in the latter moments of his acceptance speech that summer in Chicago.
Believe. Believe in what America can do, and believe in what America can be. And with the help of that vast, unfrightened, dedicated, faithful majority of Americans, I say to this great convention tonight, and to this great nation of ours, I am ready to lead our country.
Coming up on The Political Junkie, anti-war activist Sam Brown describes the violence that unfolded on the streets of Chicago during the convention.
And there were something that were dubbed daily dozers, which were Jeeps with barbed wire frames on the front of them. And these Jeeps started driving into the crowd with this barbed wire pushing people back. And of course, there was no place that people could be pushed to because we were already cheek by jowl in the street.
Stay tuned.
In 2014, The Flick by Annie Baker won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama and the 2013 Obie Award for Playwriting. And starting on Thursday, June 14th, the Henry Ford College Theater Arts Department presents this award-winning play directed by HFC theater instructor Brandon Gantz. The Flick will run for 8 performances from the Adjoy Auditorium in Building F of Henry Ford College's main campus. HFC students are offered a discounted ticket price, and you can go online to hfcc.edu and click on Campus Life for more information and to purchase tickets.
Welcome back. I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie. In the days leading up to the convention in Chicago, there were two different moods circulating among the anti-war, anti-Johnson Democrats. Some felt resigned. Bobby Kennedy was dead, and many of them couldn't bring themselves to unite behind Jean McCarthy. Hubert Humphrey's nomination was seen as a certainty. But others remained angry. They refused to let the party go on record as supporting Johnson's conduct of the war. They resented the thought of a candidate winning the nomination without having entered a single primary. They were going to Chicago to let the party leaders know how they felt. Sam Brown played a big role in all of this. He was the youth coordinator for the McCarthy campaign, and he was getting ready for Chicago himself. We're fortunate to have Sam on the program this week. Right now, we're reaching him in Guam, of all places. Sam, it's wonderful having you on the program again.
Thank you, Ken. It's nice to be here.
And I'm sure it's nice to be there. Here you're in Guam. Why are you in Guam?
Actually, I'm in Palau, which even more remote.
And why are you in Palau?
My daughter is living here with her husband who works for the Nature Conservancy and her new 4-month-old baby. So my wife and I are here visiting in Palau.
Now, you've been to, I said Guam at first, but you've been to Guam before, right?
I have been to Guam. I was in Guam in 1970, not because I chose to be there, but because I was in Vietnam. And there was a demonstration at the U.S. Embassy, where I was seen with a group of Vietnamese, basically students and Buddhist monks. And the police came to my door the following day and explained to me that I could either go to jail in Vietnam or I could be on the 2 o'clock Pan Am flight to Guam. And that seemed like a really simple choice for me.
Yeah, I'd make that choice in a heartbeat. Exactly right. Well, let me ask you about your role in the McCarthy campaign. When did that start?
Well, before there was a McCarthy. For almost a year before that, Al Lowenstein, Curtis Gans, Harold Dickies, and a bunch of people at local levels in Wisconsin and New Hampshire particularly, but a number of other states, California and New York, had been organizing something called the Alternative Candidate Task Force or the Dump Johnson Movement or the...
I remember the Coalition for a Democratic Alternative, right?
Coalition for a Democratic Alternative, exactly. And we created a series of new organizations in many states, new Democrats, who were insurgents against the war, but focused on Democratic Party politics. And my role in all of that was to pull together during that year the student piece, which sort of underlay the ground troops for the campaign that was upcoming. So I spent that year pretty much traveling. I had been involved before that with a lot of anti-war demonstrations, so I knew a lot of people. So I'd spent my time doing that. And then when we found a candidate, after asking Bobby, who declined, and approaching several others, when Gene McCarthy decided to be the candidate, we basically had a campaign in waiting for whoever that candidate was.
So basically, it sounds like the mission and the cause was far more important than the identity of the candidate.
Oh, certainly. Gene McCarthy was not the first choice. He was the one who stood up, and when he did, we all saluted, because that's what we had been looking for, was someone who would take a leadership position. So when he announced, there was a great enthusiasm. I have to say that the first meeting in Chicago of the organizers from around the country, when Senator McCarthy came, and as I recall, there was enormous excitement when he came into the room and a good deal less excitement when he left the room. We had a long lecture and a poetry reading, and it was not exactly the rousing political speech you would expect. But that's what we came to expect from Senator McCarthy during the next months, was a thoughtful approach, never trying to sort of stir the troops so much as to help the country understand what the war was about and why it was wrong.
In the days and weeks leading to Chicago, did you entertain any thought that Humphrey could be stopped?
Not really, not after Bobby was killed. I think Senator McCarthy understood it really before many of the people in the campaign. There was a great sense in the campaign that we should carry on, that we could win this. I think Senator McCarthy understood that the delegates at the time, as you will recall, were largely selected by party machinery, not by primary, and that there was little or no chance, in fact, no chance, that Gene McCarthy was going to be the Democratic nominee. And he understood that well and sort of backed away from the campaign. There was a lot of talk among campaign workers. There was a lot of reciting that Simon and Garfunkel song, "Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio? The Nation Turns Its Lonely Eyes to You," or whatever that phrase is, because we just wondered, he just sort of disappeared. And I think he understood that it was a losing cause and that stirring everybody up would only lead to greater letdown when it didn't happen. I don't know that that was the right decision on his part, but it was his decision.
The fact that Senator McGovern got into the race in mid-August, was that basically a reaction to the fact that McCarthy was not there when he was needed the most?
No. I think that was largely because of Kennedy people who couldn't bring themselves to support McCarthy and were looking for an alternative. And they found Senator McGovern. And frankly, there was a good deal of resentment among the McCarthy people about that at the time.
I was going to say that they resented the fact that Bobby got in the race after New Hampshire. And then when McCarthy is trying to unite the anti-war forces in Chicago, here along comes Senator McGovern as a Kennedy alternative.
Exactly.
What was it like when you arrived in Chicago? Did you feel the tension as you were getting there?
Yes. I mean, I had been asked by the campaign. I knew many of the people who were involved in organizing the demonstrations. And we were deeply against the demonstrations. We thought it was counterproductive. There might have been some ways that things could have been done, but marching without permits, being engaged in civil disobedience was not going to lead us to any good conclusion in the view of the campaign. So my job was to try to work with people, because I had known Tom Hayden for many years and Rennie Davis, and there was a split among the people who were there. I don't know if you've talked to Tom about that, but, you know, Dave Dellinger and some of the old pacifists had a much different attitude than Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and some of the, I mean, there was as much a split in the demonstrators as in some ways as there was between some of the demonstrators and the McCarthy campaign. There was a good deal of tension about how those demonstrations were to be organized in order to minimize conflict, so that if there was conflict, it would fall squarely on the shoulders of the police and not on the demonstrators.
Were you outside the convention hall during the clashes between the police and the demonstrators? Did you, what did you see if you were?
the night of the big clash, the night of the vote on the peace plank and the night of the police attack on the demonstrators, the last night. There had been clashes in previous nights. But on the last night of the convention, or the next to the last night, when there was the big attack by the police outside the Hilton, I was at the Hilton. And as it happens, I was sitting in Michigan, in the middle of Michigan Avenue, where we had blocked traffic, with Carl Oglesby, the then president of SDS. And he was saying, you know, the police are going to attack us. And I said, Carl, don't be crazy. There are television cameras up on the balconies at the Hilton. The whole world is watching. How could they possibly attack when whatever they do is going to be seen by everyone in the world? That would be just completely nuts. And Daley is not crazy. Well, it turned out he was right and I was wrong. Daley was crazy, or his police were crazy.
I want to play two pieces of tape right now. The way it sounded like in the beginning of the demonstrations, which sounded peaceful, or started peaceful, and then you'll hear the violence start. Let me play these two pieces of tape. And then as the police came down Michigan Avenue, the confrontations and the violence started. Let's listen. I don't know if you could tell from that audio clip, but I'm sure you feel it, Sam.
Well, that first piece, when you were playing that, that's when I was sitting in the middle of the street. I mean, there were thousands of us out there. And, yes, we had blocked the street, but so what? It wasn't a big deal. And then suddenly this unbelievable violence began to erupt on the edges of the demonstration. And there were something that were dubbed Daily Dozers, which were Jeeps with barbed wire frames on the front of them, about 6 feet high and 8 or 10 feet wide. And these Jeeps started driving into the crowd with this barbed wire pushing people back. And, of course, there was no place that people could be pushed to because we were already cheek by jowl in the street. You couldn't compact the crowd or push it. Where were they going to push it to? There was no place to go. So suddenly the police were coming. They were beating people on the edges of the crowd. People in the middle of the crowd were being crushed. People falling through windows or being pushed through plate glass windows along Michigan Avenue. That was not looting. That was not vandalism. That was people who were just being crushed and pushed into those windows. And then the police came in just swinging clubs and beating everyone in sight and with tear gas. And you couldn't escape it. And about that time, of course, on the convention floor, the delegates saw on television or heard on the radio what was going on downtown. And there was that famous scene with Rybakov on the platform and Richard Daley shouting racist expletives from the floor. Meanwhile, the police uptown, his police, and what the Kerner Commission later called a police riot — that's not some left-wing phrase, that was an established government report — said there was a police riot. And that's exactly what happened.
I was just going to say, there was also a lot of violence, not only outside, but inside the convention as well. I remember, as viewers watched, CBS News correspondent Dan Rather was on the convention floor getting pushed and shoved by security officials. Let me play as part of that tape.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir, I'm trying to.
I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walter, as you can see,
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall. I'm sorry to be out of breath, but somebody belted me in his stomach during that. What happened is a Georgia delegate, at least he had a Georgia delegate sign on, was being hauled out of the hall. We tried to talk to him to see why, who he was, and what the situation was. And at that instant, the security people... Well, as you can see, put me on the deck. I didn't do very well.
I think we've got a bunch of thugs here, Dan. If I may be permitted to say so.
Wow, Sam, right?
Yeah, wow, indeed. And at the same time, on television was, as I said, was that famous Ribbikoff Daily exchange at the front. I mean, it was really crazy inside the convention hall and, well, not as crazy as it was outside. I mean, outside there were hundreds of people being arrested and others beaten. It was just completely crazy. And I think that convention and the way it played out in the end may very well have cost Humphrey the election. It left an impression that was indelible. He failed to move away from Johnson soon enough. He lost by, it turns out, very, very narrowly at the end of the day. And certainly that narrow margin might have been quite different had there been unanimous or even grudging support from the entire party.
Sam Brown was the youth coordinator for the presidential candidacy of Eugene McCarthy. He later headed up the moratorium committee to end the war in Vietnam. Sam, thanks so much for sharing your memories of 1968.
Ken, thank you. I appreciate it.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
After the break, we'll hear from Senator George McGovern on the dissension inside the convention hall. And from anti-war activist Tom Hayden on what was going on outside. That's coming up on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin.
Once upon a time, there was a nice house that lived with a family. The house loved the family and took care of them. One day, it started to rain and rain. The house wanted to protect the family, but the water got inside and ruined everybody's everything. The house was so sad, but the family didn't think it could happen. They told the house that they would take better care of her, always.
Protect what matters. Learn more about your flood risk at floodsmart.gov/care.
You're listening to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Earlier in the program, Sam Brown was talking about how Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's dream of a successful 4 days turned into a nightmare for him, and how, in one of the most dramatic speeches in convention history, Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribbikoff stood up and, directing his comments at Daley, decried what he called the Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. Ribbikoff was up on the podium to nominate George McGovern, the South Dakota senator who entered the race in mid-August. McGovern had been a Kennedy supporter, and even after Bobby Kennedy's assassination, the forces of RFK and Eugene McCarthy could not iron out their differences. McCarthy never showed up at the convention that year, but McGovern did. Back in 2004, in a convention special for NPR, I talked to Senator McGovern about that time and about Ribbikoff's speech.
He captured the spirit of everything that was going on, both inside the convention hall and out in the street. And he knew that he had scored heavily by the tremendous applause he got even inside the convention hall. And more to the point, he knew what was going on in radio land and in television land outside of the hall.
Mr. Chairman, I have a speech here. As I look at the confusion in this hall and watch on television the turmoil and violence that is competing with this great convention for the attention of the American people. There is something else in my heart tonight, and not the speech that I prepared to give. The youth of America rallied to the standards of men like George McGovern, like they did to the standards of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have a National Guard.
You bet.
How hard it is to accept the truth when we know the problems facing our nation.
I was very proud of Senator Rybakov. He made that speech extemporaneously and cast aside his prepared text. But if there was ever a case of a politician seizing the moment, Senator Rybakov did that in 1968.
There's a violent disturbance of some kind going on in the choked aisle directly beneath this booth at the South Dakota Standard. The aisle is absolutely full. Men are struggling with each other. Blows are struck.
It was an exciting, fascinating experience for the people who were there and for the people watching on television or listening over the radio. There's no question that campaign had interest. The National Press Corps was in their element all the way through that convention.
Forcing their way through the aisles. People, there go half a dozen members of the South Dakota delegation being knocked off their chairs. They were just standing there as spectators. They're giving the thumbs down.
Continue with the call of the states. Go on to the say they pass.
Wisconsin.
Mr. Chairman, thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago.
People knew that that was their one opportunity to get the microphone, and so people that felt strongly about the war, they took the occasion of answering the roll to make a little speech on how important they thought it was that the next time around we have a convention that's more representative of public opinion.
That was from my 2004 conversation with Senator George McGovern. McGovern's last comment proved prophetic. The rules he and others in the Democratic Party helped implement after that convention ensured that never again would the nominee be decided by the bosses instead of the people, to use McGovern's words. In fact, 4 years later, McGovern himself would take advantage of the new rules, win key primary contests, and go on to win the nomination himself, only to lose to President Richard Nixon in a 49-state landslide.
We are canceling all our regular programs for the next 8 hours so that ABC News can bring you full coverage of the 1972 elections.
It was not a night you needed 8 hours to find out who won. But back to 1968. While the delegates inside the convention were about to affirm what was already known, that Vice President Hubert Humphrey was going to win the nomination, the mayhem outside continued. Many young people had come to Chicago to protest the war in Vietnam. And even if they couldn't prevent Humphrey's nomination, they wanted to tell the Democratic Party that President Johnson's war policy had to be changed. Rima Rudd was one of those young people. A strong opponent of the war, she had come to Chicago to lend her voice. Rima, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Oh, thank you.
So tell me, who was Rima Rudd in the summer of 1968?
Oh, goodness. Much younger, clearly. I was a teacher. I was teaching in those years. I was teaching high school. I was involved in the anti-war movement in the very beginning of the women's self-help movement. I was profoundly influenced, I would say, by all of the earlier events in 68, including the uprisings in Europe.
And what made you decide to go to Chicago?
Well, I was actually on my way to California to visit some friends, but I had a very good friend, Shelley Wiener, who had months earlier moved to Chicago. He was a director. He worked with the Actors Studio in New York, and he was doing some really interesting theater stuff in Chicago, and he was opening up his house for the Clean for Gene kids. And I changed my plans, and I made my reservation so that I would stop in Chicago to help out. And I also, in my heart, I wanted to be, in some small way, part of what was going to happen in Chicago. And actually, my first incident happened several days early, because I went out shopping, you know, to load the house with breakfast stuff for the kids who were going to camp on his living room floor. And I was just walking through the street. I don't remember that I was dressed in any particular, or that I was outrageous looking, but I was taunted by police who had cruised by, you know, yelling out, "Hey, yippee, hey, yippee." You know, something like, "You come to Chicago, we're ready for you." You know, it was very scary. It was very scary.
Were you a McCarthy person?
Yeah, I was. I was kind of betwixt and between. You know, was I McCarthy versus McGovern? Certainly, I was for both of them. I was not a Kennedy supporter, although I liked him. But McCarthy, McGovern, both of them really appealed to me.
And what were some of your early memories of that week? Were you out in the streets during the demonstrations?
Well, no. We were helping set up the apartment for the kids who were coming in with sleeping bags who were going to sleep over. And my friend Shelley was very involved in the guerrilla theater. And I'm sorry to say I don't remember the specific scenarios that they were developing. But if you recall, guerrilla theater was set up like something would happen on a street corner. And it was theater, but the people on that street corner or passing by didn't know that this was theater. And it was supposed to be something provocative that would make people stop and pay attention. And they'd pay attention to the scene, and then it was clear and it was announced that this was theater, and indirectly bring a message but cause discussion. So I was moving with them, and we went to Grant Park. So I remember Grant Park at night. It seemed like thousands of people gathering, some fear and trepidation. So those are the dark memories. But I was, you know, I was not a leader. I went to all the marches in Washington. I'm embarrassed to say that I was too frightened to go down south to march for civil rights, although I supported it. But I kept to the sidelines. You know, I was not one to be in the center or at the forefront of the crowd.
Now, you weren't beaten by the police, but you did come across many kids who were.
Yes, I did. And actually, we spent the next evening and almost a lot of the next day taking care of those kids. Shelley had a large apartment by New York standards. You know, the living room was set up, you know, so that all the furniture was aside for sleeping bags, you know, in the middle. It was just a whole bunch of kids. But those sleeping bags were like, you know, beds. I mean, no one who was seriously hurt was at the apartment. They were obviously taken for medical care. But kids who had their heads banged up, you know, or their shoulders bleeding, or, you know, so I remember that it was a kind of low-level medic scene.
So 50 years later, when you think of Chicago, when you think of that convention, when you think of that time, what comes rushing back to you?
The planning of the police, that they were truly anticipating riots. And my sense was that they were perfectly willing to cause them if need be. There was such a level of antagonism against youth, against the left, against those of us who were protesting. I mean, I subsequently learned that I, you know, turned out I was a community organizer later when I moved to California, that I was a very good speaker. But I was speaking mostly to those people who agreed with me, and I wasn't doing a great job speaking to those who disagreed. So I think many of us in the 60s, in the anti-war movement, in the feminist movement, somehow or another were not connecting with and not communicating with the people that were of a different persuasion, I'll say. And that's why I got into health, because my work in health, you were able to talk about social justice in a way that people didn't get so antagonized. So I remember the volatility and the disconnect between the adults, those in power, and young people.
Reamer Rudd is a member of the faculty at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, but back in 1968, she was a high school teacher in the Bronx. Reamer, thanks so much for sharing your memories from 50 years ago.
Oh, thank you for asking me. I'm delighted.
I fell in love again. All things go, drove to Chicago. All things know, we sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind, I don't mind, I made a lot of mistakes in my mind.
It's hard to imagine the thought of organization in a world of anarchy, but amongst the chaos on the streets, there were several who led the protesters. One was Tom Hayden, a well-known anti-war activist. He was part of the so-called Chicago Seven, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who stood trial the following year for their roles in the demonstrations. I spoke to Tom in February of 2015 regarding the 1968 protests. What was the original plan for Chicago and the convention? You weren't going to stop Humphrey. You weren't going to end the war. What was the goal?
Well, it had been a very frustrating time, painfully so, as you mentioned. The candidate who I leaned toward, Robert Kennedy, had been murdered. The leader of the civil rights movement, Dr. King, had been murdered. There were two of several murders in the 60s that really made progressive social change impossible, at least within the system. And the war was raging. And so we had the idea that we had to somehow awaken the peace movement and the rank-and-file Democratic members of the Democratic Party to the need for an anti-war platform and, if necessary, a new candidate. Some people in our coalition on the conservative side of it were big proponents of Eugene McCarthy, senator from Minnesota. Young people marched in the snow of New Hampshire and helped him almost upset President Johnson on an anti-war platform. Other people favored an attempt to get 100,000 people to flood downtown with protests in the belief that the delegates would hear us and they would vote for a peace platform and rebuke President Johnson. We never got permits for any of our marches, and therefore the large demonstrations never happened, and you started to get bedlam in the streets because people tried to march anyway, but they had no permits and police would chase them down and beat them and gas them and drag us away to Cook County Jail. So it was a situation where we thought the question was, how important was this war to the Democrats winning the election? It seemed to us they had to choose. If they wanted to elect Humphrey, if they wanted to elect a Democrat, it was clear that the policy had to change, and it was the refusal to change the policy, but instead to crush the demonstrators in the streets that kind of foretold the outcome in which Vice President Humphrey lost to Nixon in November, and the rest was history.
Tom Hayden was later indicted on federal charges of conspiracy and incitement to riot. The charges were eventually dropped. I spoke with Hayden again at another Democratic convention, this one in Philadelphia in 2016. He was bemused, for lack of a better word, over everyone who was trying to compare the tensions between the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders forces with what happened in 68.
Well, in 68, the FBI fed a lot of information to the city of Chicago saying that Abby Hoffman was going to have sex on the beaches after giving LSD to all the delegates and flipping them out, and that would be followed by an armed revolution by the Black Panthers on the South Side. So there was really a promotion of chaos. It's the media trope of the week, disorder, disorder, disorder. Now, I may be wrong, and by Friday we may have disorder, but I have not seen such disorder compared to the 20-odd national scenes of disorder that I have been through, like Columbia strike or the moratoriums, well, many, many
even
things.
Even before you get to the moratorium in 69, let's talk about Chicago 68. I mean, you had a Democratic convention there where you had a nominee who basically won, got the nomination without running in a primary, let alone winning a primary, and
right.
That was Hubert Humphrey, plus the fact that he ran on a pro-Vietnam War ticket.
Until he
changed in September. But,
yeah.
But, I mean, that's not what the Democratic Party was about in 68.
It's quite changed. You know, an anti-Vietnam generation of Democrats came along and got elected to many offices. And I think it's a solid part of the party's memory. And I think they'll push hard to not repeat anything that reminds us of that horrible past.
Tom Hayden died 3 months after my conversation with him at the 2016 convention. He was 76 years old and had been suffering from heart problems.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go to warm Haiti? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on.
The Democratic National Convention in Chicago ended as expected, with the nomination of Hubert Humphrey as the party's presidential nominee. Even before the convention started, Humphrey knew he was boxed in and in for a rough ride.
Mr. Vice President, in what ways do you disagree with President Johnson's positions with reference to Vietnam?
Well, would you mind if I just stated my position on Vietnam? Because the President of the United States is not a candidate, and I did not come here to repudiate the President of the United States. I want that quite clear.
Hubert Humphrey deserved better. Yes, he got what he always wanted, the nomination of his party for president. But the chaos of the convention drowned out his candidacy. The whole world was indeed watching. When he finally found his voice, when he broke from President Johnson's war policy, it was the end of September. By then, it was too late.
In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready.
The Democratic Convention in Chicago was just one part of what unfolded as a terrible, exhausting political year. Of course, there's so much more to remember from 1968 than we can possibly fit in a single program. You can find out more about all the episodes in our series, 1968, 50 Years Later, on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and our weekly email newsletter. If you've got comments or questions, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. I'm Ken Rudin. The election of 1968 came down to Richard Nixon.
America's in trouble today because her leaders have failed.
Hubert Humphrey.
The months and the years ahead will severely test our America.
And George Wallace.
I shall turn back the public school systems to the people of the respective states.
50 years later, a look at how that election reshaped a divided nation on a special edition of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie.
The 20th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national town hall meeting, broadcasting live on Tuesday, June 12th. Tune in to hear the stories from our homeless citizens and people living in poverty. This year's Homelessness Marathon will be held in conjunction with the Poor People's March for Our Lives and will originate in Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Tuesday, June 12th. Heard right here on this radio station.
Join WHFR from noon until midnight on Tuesday, June 12th as we broadcast for the 20th Annual Homelessness Awareness Marathon from Washington, D.C. Listen online at WHFR.FM or on your FM radio from the only station that's making waves, WHFR. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio. Featuring local and independent artists.
Time. That's why my